welcome to the United States Institute of Peace. It's great to see such a crowd here on a Friday afternoon. It typically isn't this way in Washington, D.C., so obviously that speaks to the caliber of the guest of honor that we have today. As you all know, Iraq continues to be America's greatest foreign policy challenge, and the U.S. Institute of Peace works very closely with its Iraqi counterparts to help stabilize Iraq and empower Iraqis to participate in their new form of democracy. The Iraqis play a dominant role in overcoming the challenges facing their country. They recognize this role and they're very active in what they are doing. They feel the pain, they feel the war. A key element to stabilizing Iraq is the success or the attempt to be successful in rebuilding their military. The success of that effort will greatly influence how the United States succeeds in its endeavor in Iraq, too. Today, we are fortunate enough to have Lieutenant General Nazir Abadi, the Deputy Chief of Staff of the Iraqi Joint Forces Command, with us. Man of great integrity and vision, whom I've known since early 2004. He has been intimately involved in the rebuilding of the Iraqi military, in designing its structure, establishing its training plan, and trying to build a quality institution that can meet the demands and requirements of his country. He has spent this past week in Washington meeting a variety of individuals and groups throughout the city, and today caps his stay in the city, and he will depart shortly after the conclusion of this session. As is usual with the practice here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, we will have him deliver his remarks in 15 or 20 minutes, and then we will open it up to question and answers. And at that time, those of you who have questions that you'd like to ask, I would ask that you would line up over at the microphone, and then we will proceed with those questions that you have. I hope that everybody had a chance to pick up General Abadi's biography up front and some of the other publications that we have. So, sir, without further ado, I would like to introduce Lieutenant General Nazir Abadi.
Challenges we are facing and are affecting our performance and readiness to take over battle space and begin transition from the coalition. And finally, we will find out if there is light at the end of the tunnel. Looking through the window to our past. Mesopotamia, the birthplace of Prophet Abraham, is a land of lush vegetation and abundant wildlife. It has attracted people since the beginning of creation. By 4000 BC, the first settlers, the Sumerians, controlled the flooding of the Tigris and the Euphrates and founded agricultural communities. To them is attributed the invention of the wheel chariot, bronze weapons, and the first conscript army. After this period, the Akkadians, in present-day Iraq, were the first empire builders, conquering Egypt and Ethiopia and establishing political organization. All this was before the world-renowned Babylonians took over control of the land. Ladies and gentlemen, it is important to remember that the past is followed, as Shakespeare said. To ignore the past is to have to relearn it, relearn its lessons painfully. From the distant past, I would like to bring you back to reality and the present day. And we start with the threats that we face. We have both internal and external threats. The internal threats can be divided into the jihadists, representing the Wahhabis, who are trying to turn the world into an Islamic nation ruled by the laws of extremists. Former Ba'athis, dreaming of uniting the country again under the Ba'ath Party and regaining authority and power. Sectarian violence, aiming at disuniting the country and provoking Sunnis against Shias to fight each other. Militias, trying to secure power and financial gain. Criminals, taking advantage of the chaos to maximize their power and profits. The external threats can be summarized as follows. Some see democratic process as a threat to their existence. Some are worried about Iran's infiltration into Iraq. Others fear the presence of the USA at their doorstep. Slide, please. Many of you are familiar with how nations counter terrorism. And I think it's the US that has invented the term DIME. It's a concept for describing the elements of national power: diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. You see here the diplomatic, political, and informational means the new Iraqi government is seeking to employ to address the causes and consequences of the insurgency. We are, however, inexperienced in the use of those means. Moreover, the effects of the final years of Saddam's dictatorship and the violence that pursued the coalition invasion have largely destroyed the middle class and caused it to flee Iraq. And we all know we cannot have democracy without the middle class. Here we see the economic and military means our government is striving to employ. The economics in Iraq are not now favorable, with widespread unemployment and inadequate investment by the government and the international community in generating much-needed economic growth. On the military side, we are simultaneously building and deploying our forces, trying as rapidly as possible to transition from the coalition control to Iraqi control. In sum, to sum it up, the dime is not worth a dime without sound direction. We need ahead a strategy, which means by which we can govern those elements of national power. We have in Iraq the two main threats were Syria, because it is the base for support for the terrorists, and we have Chad, Jaisal Mahdi, as the militias. Both could have been tackled earlier. For Syria, Syria is a poor country, and to have Syria on our side, we could have thought of building a pipeline from Iraq to the Mediterranean through Syria. That would have benefited Syria a lot. And by that financial gain, I think Syria would have sent its own army to protect that pipeline. Same thing with Jab. Hafez al-Assad started small, but he had the popularity of the people. And we should have there and then gained Hafez to our side and be on the side of the government. He still is. He has a representation in the government. But things have happened that we have attacked him so much that he is against the U.S. and he wants the U.S. to go out. Planning ahead, we have had those two on our side. And again, you can give a lot of examples. The attack on the Golden Mosque as well. This was not properly protected, and all the violence that was ensued afterwards, the previous Iranian violence, was the result of that attack. Had we been able to protect that, we would not have this escalation of violence. Now we try to visit the armed forces. In all our endeavors, it is vital to begin with a mission, which should be the aim of all our actions. Our mission in Iraq is unique because it's the only army, I think, in the world that is totally focused on the insurgency. The army's mission is to destroy the insurgents and the terrorists, to deny them safe havens, to disrupt their lines of communication and support and supply. Besides this, the insurgents started attacking the pipelines, the bloodline for Iraq for survival. So the government gave us another task, the task of protecting the pipeline. So we built 17 SRDs, strategic infrastructure battalions, to protect those pipelines. And the Navy was again given the task of protecting the oil platform itself. Let us see how we are organized to perform those missions. This is our organization chart. The Ministry of Defense headquarters has the Joint Forces headquarters integrated. We work in the same building. Most of the units and personnel are under the command of the Ground Forces headquarters. The Ground Force Command has 9 infantry divisions, light infantry divisions, and 1 mechanized division, plus the 17 SIB battalions that I mentioned. The Air Force Command has 2 reconnaissance squadrons, 3 helicopter squadrons, and a transport squadron. The Navy has a patrol boat squadron, an assault boat squadron, and a marine battalion. We have Special Operations Brigade, consisting of Counterterrorism Force, commando battalion, a support battalion, a reconnaissance company, and a training and development department. The training and doctrine command will begin to operate in September. It is NATO that has undertaken the task of building the training command. It consists of a tactical training command and the National Defense University. We also have a support command. It is yet to be formed, but we have in place the National Depot, supply points, and regional support units. Units in gray, the ones you see there, they are yet to be formed. Slide, please. When we set up our divisions, we gave them the same areas of operation as those of the coalition for a good reason. Firstly, because they can do joint operations, and secondly, they can work together, and thirdly, when transition counts, then they can transition from the coalition and take their own battle space. Our second and third CDCO divisions operate with multinational division role. Fourth and fifth divisions operate with multinational force center north center, the 101st division. The sixth and eighth are operate with multinational force Baghdad, force ID. First and seventh operate with the Marines of West from Ali-Berger, and the eighth and tenth operate with the Brits outside. As of today, we have 77 battalions, 16 brigade headquarters, and 4 division headquarters owning their own battle space, which means they are in control of their own operations, with the coalition providing only supporting capabilities. By the end of this year, we expect 103 battalions and 9 divisions to be able to have their own battle space. The fourth goal, force goal for our 10 division ground forces, this short year. We plan now on the 10th Division being under the command of the Ground Force Headquarters and having a total of 26 Brigade Headquarters with a command of 118 battalions. We are also continuously assessing our missions and forces to ensure we have what we need to do the job and we need adjustments as necessary. We have a very rigorous process for assessment of the readiness of our ground combat forces to accomplish their mission and be able to take over responsibility of operations from the coalition to own their own battle space. To own battle space, the units need to reach tier level 2. What we see here is the readiness assessment criteria developed to help define when units are ready to operate independently. This is a joint venture between us and the coalition. Level 4 at the bottom indicates unit formation. Level 3 means that units have been formed but have not had enough training and experience to reach the green color and can only perform alongside the coalition forces. Once the personnel you see at the top, command and control C2, training, sustainment, equipment, and leadership reach the green color, those units become tier level 2 and can own battle space and conduct independent missions with little support from the coalition. Tier level 1 means fully independent operational capabilities. It also means that the like now to show you the organization of the Air Force and Navy that support the armed forces and their combating terrorism and the insurgency. The Air Force mission is to support the ground forces in our war on terrorism. The organization, as you see, with the Air Force, you see here, with the Air Force organized to perform reconnaissance and transport missions. In the future, we will evolve to include other normal Air Force. Navy. The Navy's main mission is to safeguard the oil platforms and the Iraqi coastline. It consists of naval squadron and the marine battalion. Our special operations forces are small in size but big in accomplishments. Their combat elements consist of a commando battalion and a counter-terrorism task force. These forces have been our most successful weapon in countering terrorism. They specialize in capturing high-level, high-value targets and operate in close coordination with the police. At present, they have their own transport and rely on the coalition for air transport. In the future, we plan to provide air support for them with the Air Force. The support and training elements are also currently in the brigade and in the future will be closely integrated in the training command. Let us see the total strength of our armed forces. This is our current strength. We have a planned strength of 160,000. We expect to reach by the end of this year. While we have made a very impressive progress towards meeting our goals in terms of capability and size, we have significant challenges in accomplishing our mission. Permit me to review some of the major challenges we face. The creative energy that drives our joint forces forward in accomplishing their mission exists alongside the strong emotions from the past. Our legacy is one of centralized authority under the Ba'ath Party, which limited our development and stifled our leadership. In the present, we are caught in a cycle of action and reaction that has escalated violence against ordinary citizens to an unprecedented level. This is not typical in Iraq. This is not typical in Iraq culture. We are vulnerable to being exploited by our adversaries in a way that challenges our democratic experiment and inflicts the worst damage to our citizens. We do not have a tradition of NCOs. We are, and we are trying to set up a school and intensive our NCOs to the UK and to the US for their training. We're trying a new concept of volunteer force to replace the poorly paid and inadequately trained conscript armies of our recent past. We have not in the past integrated our forces. The Air Force does not work with you. The Army does not work with you. They're all independent. And now we have a joint force to try to integrate all still have a challenge with the problem with language. History and our new experiment in democracy place a burden on our shoulders. We are challenged to learn from the past so that we don't repeat past mistakes but honor past successes. From the past, we also have some indications of the future. Our army has already established an established record in organizing itself and entered testing effective operations in Najd, Fallujah, Samarra, Al-Aqsa, and the campaign in the west from Baghdad all the way to Afar. We must build in the present of these successes to reinforce our young democracy. We will be responsible for our future. We must shape it today and not passively wait for it to be shaped by others. We are ready to accept these challenges and we work with our coalition, partners, and the Ministry of Interior to succeed. Our countrymen depend on us. We shall not fail. The implications for leaders are significant. We in Iran are very conscious of the importance of the path we are following. Our country is called again to demonstrate the mettle of its people and the courage of its leaders. Your country has been a beacon for democracy and a staunch supporter to those less fortunate brothers around the world. In the name of my countrymen, I offer you our deep appreciation and ask that you remain steady in your purpose, patient, and persistent. History would record whether we had the will and the endurance to prevail in these trying times, alongside our partners from the United States of America. I am confident history will record our joint success.
We will now take questions. Again, please line up at the microphone here and identify yourself and the organization that you work for. The microphone right over here. And please ask your question in general. Let's hear your mic.
Okay.
together with the forces from five brigades from the Ministry of Interior now fighting to back them. And you hear of basically sectarian violence that's taking place in Baghdad. We had an operation in Baghdad called Together Forward. And this is the latest operation that we've conducted. We have tried to learn from the past lessons of the past operations. What we had done in the past was tackle Baghdad's old Baghdad, not part of the Baghdad is a very good city. It has about 6.5 million inhabitants. And we had failed, we failed in the past. So what we decided was that there are hot spots in Baghdad in Israel. A lot of violence in them. So the plan was to isolate those areas one by one, get them secure, then move to another area, then move to another area. And we have done that. We have done that very successfully. The areas that we have tackled are secure, but the insurgents run away to another area to take back another area. The insurgents is not an army. Just a few people take a car, a DVID, or drive past a car, speeding cars, or I might place an IED. Do you even see if this army that is operating back? There's no such thing. People are going to work, doing their everyday life, but we cannot have enough people to be able to perform, to guard Baghdad. We hope that this plan, Together Forward, will be successful. We are isolating areas, searching those areas, clearing them from weapons, and then moving to others. This will take time. Now we've done once. We've, I think, cleared 3 or 4 areas. But in other areas, that these things are taking place.
And the second part was about the people's community.
This is, I think this is came from the Prime Minister, that this, the politician will have to get in touch with the people, with this sectarian violence. The politicians that we have been elected by the people, and they, the people do not listen to them, quite as well as that politicians. Because the reconciliation program that the Prime Minister has said, to have a dialogue with the people throughout the nation and to get the people and the politicians together to be able to solve the sectarian problem.
Next question.
My name is Rak Mahian, and I'm from Malikun, and under the challenge ranking, yes, your number, under the challenging headings, how you address the problem of the corruption and the influence of the political party on the recruitment procedure of the new Iraqi army?
Okay, recruitment. When we started the new Iraqi army, and trained as good by the coalition. The institute especially for that task. Was General Paul Peter, then General Petraeus, and now we have General Dempsey heading that organization. The plan was that I presented the army. Had presented the leadership, and those leaderships would be enlightened and told through modern ways of human rights and educated away from centralized authority and other things that we have discussed before. That took place. But as time passed by, the security situation increased to a certain extent that we could not have, we did not have enough training establishments to be able to train soldiers to be able to cope with the insurgency. What happened was that the coalition divisions themselves undertook upon themselves to recruit people from the areas that they are working at and train them and have them, and they call them, if you remember, the ICDC, and then they became the National Guard, and then they became the armed forces. We never have a problem with recruitment. We have, up to the as of today, 14,000 people on the waiting list, waiting for their turn. We have 5 training establishments training our soldiers. And corruption could be in the areas where they go to give them preference one before the other. I think this is big corruption. It's $50, $20, $10, I think. And this we recognize. We put some guys from the intelligence and from personnel, from civilians, in those recruiting centers so that one would check on the other, and it's been solved.
Please, sir.
Colonel Datta, Foreign Policy Association, President of Indian Veteran Officers Association of America. General, you have made a very good presentation of how Delta Defense Forces look at present. But I suppose you must be planning a defense ahead. Who's your enemy number one, externally and internally? That's not this one question. Then you have explained the organization, but I think you have mentioned the supporting arms. First, fighting arms. What were the supporting arms? Gunners, engineers, EME, electrical and mechanical engineers, and the supply corps and the ordnance. If you could kindly throw light on this. And I would like to ask a general that what is the difference in the leadership qualities of the present army as compared to the army of yore, of Saddam Hussein? Why did they fail? Purely academic question.
Well, in my presentation, I gave the mission of the armed forces as to fight the insurgency. And we were not designed to fight an external force. I don't think any other country could challenge the coalition forces and try to attack Iraq. For the time being, we're not thinking of an army that could fight an external enemy. We're hoping by the time we get rid of the insurgency that we have a peaceful negotiation with our neighbors and live peacefully with a small army. Because as you know, armies cost a lot of money, and we're thinking of rebuilding our infrastructure, our hospitals, our schools, and have a small army, just a representative army, to be able to help other countries that need support, like we are needing support now. Secondly, you discussed the support element. You saw that we are tier level 2 and not tier level 1. What's missing with the fighting force that we have is the support element. We have the fighters, but we don't have the tail. The tail will be in place, hopefully, by the middle of next year. And with training and all, it will take about 6 months. So by the end of next year, we'll have the support tail in place. Leadership. This is a story about leadership. One, because it was Ba'ath Party, then there were preferences, party members got senior positions. Secondly, people from not only Ba'athis, but because they belong to decreased area from Mosul or from Brumadi, they had priority. There were sectarian again preferences for 30. The army people were forced to go into the army, and they paid them very little. There was little food. The equipment was not good. They were not well trained. All the elements of failure were present in the old army. This new army is a different army. We're trying people come by their own will. And we're trying to train them as best we can. They get on-the-job training with the best armies of the world, you know, fighting alongside the Americans, the British. And we're trying to give them the right equipment to fight the insurgency. We're trying to educate them on the human rights, do's and don'ts, to interact with the people. So I think it's a healthy new army that we have, and completely different from the old army that we had.
Sophie Rudenmark from the Fund for Peace. Thank you for being here today, General. I had the good fortune of attending your earlier talk this week at AEI. And as I remember from that talk, I think you said that you thought a redeployment from other areas of Iraq to Baghdad to help secure the situation would not be necessary. But within the past few days, it's become apparent that Prime Minister Maliki and President Bush are going to redeploy, I think, about 5,000 troops. And I was wondering if you could comment on that and comment on what an optimal number of coalition support troops would be for the situation in terms of making your clear and hold and build strategy work.
I recall the past presentation that I told you that we have 18 provinces and only 5 of them. We have violence, they are not secure, and the others are all secure, and there's very little violence in them, and we have the army is, as you saw, representing from up north to down south. So if we have a quiet area and we have an area that needs more troops, especially with Baghdad, as you know, the center of gravity of Iraq. The government is there, everything is there. So we do, everybody does this, to redeploy troops from one place to another, from a less needed to where it's needed. And I think we also just from our own side, 5 from your side, from our side to Baghdad. We want to get a bit of the insurgency in Baghdad and try to control it. Please.
Jocelyn Hinnamarian from United Consideration. General, you spoke at the American Enterprise Institute on Monday, and also present at that event was Michael Eisenstadt from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Now, Mr. Eisenstadt expressed a concern that to defeat the insurgency in the long term, you need to convince the insurgents that their goal cannot be achieved militarily. Some of his suggestions for that were a government-sponsored work program for internally displaced persons who might otherwise join militias, the need to dismantle insurgents smuggling weapons from the outside and outside government funding. And possibly also the need to address in the Iraqi judicial system individuals who install improvised explosives. Have you seen these, any of these as particular concerns, or how are you working maybe with the Iraqi government to address these, or how are your forces addressing these currently?
Thank you. these are all concerns that we feel, and they're reality. We have open borders because, like the army and the Ministry of Interior, all the forces were dissolved, even the border patrol. So it is a very lucrative business now, especially with the organized crime who are helping the militias need the funding. And part of the funding is coming from the criminals. They support each other because these guys will do the crime and get the money and give it to the terrorists. And the terrorists will give them the protection, facilitate their activities. It's going on and we're trying to control it. It's all there. Even from the militias as well, from all the insurgents.
Tyler Cohen from United Presses International as well. Lieutenant General, you mentioned Syria in your presentation, and my question to you is there an expressed wanting for Syria as an ally militarily or otherwise, as you discussed the pipeline, and does their relationship with Iran come into play at all?
This is a political question, it's a great question. We're trying to get as many friends as we can. They're both Syria and Iran are scared from the USA, and that's why we're not friendly with them, because the US has got rid of Saddam Hussein, and they're trying to, we already set our government and democracy. So for them, the US staying at their doorstep is a threat, as I mentioned in my brief. But we're trying to gain their friendship. You know, we cannot be at war and fight at the same time the insurgency. And they are helping the insurgency, especially Syria. Maybe Iran. I don't know.
Sir. General, thank you for coming. For excellent being consulted. My question is the following. As you continue to develop the capabilities of your armed forces, to what extent do you see technical measures being implemented and complementing the measures you're already taking, such as unmanned aerial vehicles, radars, mines to control the borders, checkpoints and roadblocks, and the introduction of a national ID card, perhaps, you know, with some of the electronic chips that you see in Europe and hopefully eventually in this technologically deficient at times country here in America. Thank you.
I think this has been addressed very much. We have a lot of the militias who are wearing uniforms, either military or MOD or MOI uniforms, and conducting raids. So what we are trying to do now, get an identity for the vehicles and the foot people to be able to differentiate them. Technology is a must, and the main source of income for Iraq, 97%, 100%, is the oil industry. And what we have done is put people alongside the pipeline to protect it. This is a very inefficient and costly way of protecting the pipelines. What we have done is that we are trying now, and I met with Boeing the other day to see whether we can have a technical solution of aircraft, unmanned aircraft flying over 24 hours. And we have sensors, radars that predict people coming close, and weapon systems to be able to, communication system to be able to communicate. But that is in place, and we're dealing with it.
Hi, General. Gary Gustafson with the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. My question relates to what you referred to earlier about trying to avoid making the mistakes of the past with previous regime and the role of the forest and how human rights abuses occurred and nobody was ever held accountable. What is the status of development of a military court system within the military and ensuring that, you know, soldiers are achieving performance standards, but particularly when something occurs, a gross human rights violation, that the soldiers responsible, the commanders responsible, are held responsible under a uniform code of military justice?
When the CPA came, they abolished all the legal system that we used to have, and they put something from their side. We, during that period, we were able to amend the laws that we had in the previous regime, and we have given this to Parliament to accept. And it is still now with Parliament to say, okay, then we can implement those newly modified rules and laws of engagement, of punishment, and everything. It isn't it.
I have a question for you, sir. Given the sectarian violence, the escalation of the sectarian violence in the present time, do you think that the Iraqi army and the coalition forces are still in control? That's my first question. And my second question is, do you think there's a gap, a political gap between the Iraqi army, given that the Iraqi army or the Minister of Defense is controlled by Sunni ministry, and the Ministry of Interior is controlled by a Shia ministry? Thank you.
We are in control. We see the insurgents, and they're never targeting us. They are targeting, but their main target is the civilians, women and children. There's no confrontation between us and them. They will always lose. Concerning the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Defense, there is no such thing as, although he is our minister is a Sunni, but he is an Iraqi. An Iraqi Sunni. He is an Iraqi. And we do not, this has come politically through, because the Sunnis did not come and join the political process. They needed representation, and we have to have a Sunni, a Shia, and a Kurd. But when you go professionally with an army and command and control structure, then that is dissolved. It's being a Sunni in a place where they have, in a battalion, they have about 750 soldiers. This is lost. And it's always representation of what the nation is consisted of. 60% Shia, 20% Sunnis, and 20%. No matter how we do it, it comes up. Of course, that is the way we are. We've made. Thank you.
My name is Mary Mullen. I want to ask just two short questions. I want to ask about the PKK in the north with the Kurds. Are they still, is that a real problem still? And I want to know if the problems in Lebanon are affecting Iraq at all.
The Kurds have the army, which we have two brigades in the north that are an answer to us with the Iraqi army. And they have the Peshmerga. The Peshmerga problem has not yet been solved because they say this is for the defense of Kurdistan. And this is a political issue for me to decide. But we do have two brigades in the north answering to us. Some of them we own, some of them they answer to the Kurdish government. And the next question was about Lebanon. I would only talk militarily. Militarily, because the Arab states and as well as France
mainly Iran. They can only retaliate on the US because it's supporting Israel. So we expected, as the minute Israel attacked Lebanon, we expected an escalation of violence because we expected that people who did not like this would come through Iraq and attack the coalition forces, or the US forces.
Brian Burton, CSIS. My question is about equipment. And I understand a lot of the equipment that Iraqi forces rely on now is leftover Soviet era equipment that was purchased by the Saddam regime. So is there any feeling that the US or the coalition maybe hasn't been doing a very thorough job or a very intensive job of providing the most advanced equipment possible, the best equipment for the Iraqi forces to accomplish their mission?
Thank you. Again, we go back to the mission of the Iraqi armed forces. We are fighting an insurgency. Insurgency is not, it's the insurgency, they fight in towns, they fight in small numbers. And to fight in a city, you need a weapon that will deliver short range and a lot of bullets, a lot of mass. The Kalashnikov is a very good weapon because it is cheap. Secondly, the Iraqis know how to use it. And this is what is required in close combat. Had we been fighting another enemy and we needed a longer range, more accuracy, then we would have to go to either an American or there's plenty in the market. But the Kalashnikov AK-47 is a reliable and efficient weapon for us to use. Armored vehicles, yes, we need armored vehicles. We only had pickups at the time, but now we had a big purchase of Humvees, Land Rovers, T-72, not only this, the armored vehicles for the So, anyways, we have several of those now coming, close to 3,200. Some of them are already in Iraq, delivered to the units, and some of them will be coming by now, from now to the end of this year.
Sir, my name is Jonathan Morgenstein. I'm here at U.S. Institute of Peace. And my question is a hypothetical: if the political issue around the issues around the Shia militias, some of the Sunni nationalist insurgent groups in the Peshmerga are resolved, do you have any perspective on if you think it would be difficult to integrate those forces, and if you think it would be a positive idea to try and integrate those forces into the standing Iraqi military?
I think our Prime Minister was very clear on this. He wanted to integrate the militias into not only the armed forces, but to the Ministry of Interior, plus to the government. And if there is a job for them there, why not have them? Because we're still about 15,000 shy, and the Ministry of Interior has to develop. People think that we are the ones that should be fighting the insurgency. It's the Ministry of Interior that should be fighting the insurgency. But because we were ready and available at the time, we were given the task waiting for the Ministry of Interior to take over. Because this is the mission for the Ministry of Interior. And as we transition from the coalition, it is for the Ministry of Interior to transition from us. We would go off to the outside, and the Ministry of Interior would be taking responsibility of the insurgency inside the cities.
Afternoon, General. Thank you. My name is Rachel Shannon. I work with SM Consulting. And I'd like to ask, you had briefly mentioned that Iraq was facing language issues. If I could ask, what type of language issues are you facing, and what are some possible solutions for those issues?
Most of the help we're getting is through from NATO and the coalition, and they all speak English. And Saddam, whoever spoke English, was a traitor or not only a traitor, he's a spy or something. We have a big language problem. And another is that the Kurds, for 10 years, they did not speak Arabic. They spoke only Kurdish, and that is a sort of a problem to have with our forces. And what we have now with the training and doctrine command have opened a school for languages, and we're trying to give bonus for those who would learn either Kurdish or Arabic. But English is a must, because they cannot go outside unless they have this incentive for them to leave the country and learn the language.
Well, General, I think you have answered your questions. Thank you very much.